You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 28th, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, my old co-host Kelly returns from the Peace Corps in Guatemala and tells us about that. Co-host Nate also brings his expertise on Danish politics to discuss the European far right. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Joining me back in studio after a year and a half away is our former co-host, Kelly. Kelly, welcome back to the show and the United States and the state of Massachusetts.
Thank you. It's good to be back, especially back in Massachusetts.
Yes. Well, we all know it's canon on this show, our deep love for the state of Massachusetts. This is our favorite part of the show. I was actually realizing we've now got, I think, 45% of all past and present hosts are in the state of Massachusetts. All right. So, for those who don't remember or are joining the show, you know, later into this process, Kelly was one of our hosts when the show was being recorded at University of Delaware, not just broadcast there. And then you went off to the Peace Corps in Guatemala. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your experiences there, things that you learned, that sort of thing. So when did you actually get down to Guatemala?
Absolutely. So I got down to Guatemala in February of 2013. We started off with about a month and a half of training, and then I swore in as a volunteer at the end of March in 2013.
So what was it that you were working on there? Because I know that you didn't know what you were going to be doing.
I had no idea. So I worked on a project called Healthy Schools, which is a joint venture between the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education down in Guatemala. And it was a unique position in Peace Corps role because the program itself belonged to the Guatemalan people and the Guatemalan government. And I was simply facilitating the program in a school district that consisted of 14 primary schools. So I worked mostly with teachers on developing a health curriculum, teaching them the learning cycle to get them to use more interactive methods in their classroom. But there was also definitely an infrastructure component to the project, trying to improve water and sanitation in the schools, as well as a community element in which we strengthen the ties with the health center and establish some parents' groups within the schools, all with the idea that the school itself can promote health in the entire community.
So getting things self-sustaining so they can continue without you.
That's the idea.
So what were a few really cool things that you got to do or experience when you were in Guatemala, either as part of the project or outside the project, any of those?
Sure. So the Healthy Schools project was my primary project, but I also served as vice president of the Gender and Development Committee within the Peace Corps post. And that was far and away my favorite part, the most interesting part of my work. And sort of as a capstone project, we hosted a celebration of women leaders and the men who support them, which was close to International Women's Day, and provided some guidance for Guatemalans as well as other Peace Corps volunteers about how to approach these difficult topics of domestic violence and how we promote women leaders in schools and health centers. And it was a really great event. We hosted a bunch of workshops, and people were able to choose which workshops they wanted to attend that they felt was most relevant to their work in their life. So that was definitely my favorite thing I did as a volunteer. But working in the schools as well was quite rewarding. I worked most closely with kids in a peer education group. So we were trying to develop a peer education program for 4th through 6th graders. And that presents quite a few challenges, but we designed a designed a program and tried our best to execute it and went back and tinkered with it and improved it, hopefully. But that was a lot of really hands-on time in the classroom. That was very, very interesting to see how a Guatemalan classroom works.
Similar at all to the U.S.
Not
or completely
at
different?
All. You know, I think one thing about living abroad is you develop an appreciation for the United States. And it is imperfect and we have a long way to go. But in Guatemala, school went from 8 to 12, supposedly, but it was more like 8:30 to 11:30 with an hour for snack in the middle. There's no law that kids have to go to school. So a lot of kids weren't enrolled in school. The kids that were enrolled came and went as they pleased. There's a lot of challenges there, and you very quickly realize the importance of education and the importance of sending all kids to school and providing them with a decent education.
Now, when you went down there, did you speak Spanish? What was your language?
So I had taken 2 semesters of Spanish at the University of Delaware. And so I could say, I like the mountains. And that's all I said to my host family for the first 2 weeks. You have a lovely country. I like the mountains. But Peace Corps provided us with awesome language training every day for the first 6 weeks we were there. And then even after that, I was able to go in for a week at a time. Twice, I think I did that just to continue to improve Spanish skills.
So by the end of it, did you feel like you were fluent or working fluency? Or
yeah, so I am technically fluent according to a test, but you still feel like, you know, my humor doesn't really translate. I'm not sure I could tell you how I feel as well. But I think even talking to expats who have lived in Guatemala for 20 years, you never really feel fluent. But I definitely can work in Spanish and enjoy working in Spanish.
Now, one thing that had sort of struck me as interesting, and maybe this is a misconception on my mm-hmm. part, but it seemed like, you know, just even a few years ago, a lot of people who would go to the Peace Corps or whatever would be virtually cut off for the whole time that they were there. And obviously there's some disparity still between, say, you know, some of the, you know, lesser developed, least developed countries in West Africa versus, you know, Latin America. But you were able to be, you know, pretty regularly online, you know, obviously you weren't just online all the time, but you were able to update folks, you know, post pictures, things like that pretty regularly. How do you think that that has changed the sort of Peace Corps experience?
Yeah, so obviously, like you said, every Peace Corps post is different. But in Guatemala, I lived an hour outside of the second biggest city. I also had a USB stick I could get internet from. And it changes everything. I mean, the internet and cell phones have made the world a lot smaller place. Peace Corps really emphasizes sharing your experience with people back home. That's one of the Peace Corps goals. And I don't know how people did that before the internet. So I think it has changed like the individual psychological experience a lot, and that not only can you communicate to people at home, but you're definitely expected to. You know, there's no, even in rural Guatemala, there's no excuse for not answering an email. So I think that just, I've had the experience of talking to some volunteers in the 70s, and it's definitely a different game. Great if you want to call home. Bad if you know, we're really trying to get off the grid for 2 years.
Back home. Yeah, yeah, start over. One of the things that I also noticed was that, you know, you had mentioned about they had sort of rebooted the program and they had not had it the previous year. So this was, you know, the first one back there. And part of that was security concerns and things like that beforehand. But it actually seems like there were quite a few momentous events while you were there. I don't know how connected you were to that, but there was, I know there was the Rios Montt genocide trial going on. There were the corruption scandals at a very high level in the government, and then street protests that were making the news even here because they were pretty significant. Was that something you were experiencing or pretty sheltered from?
Oh, yeah. So the post in Guatemala is sort of interesting in that there's only about 5 departments in Guatemala that we work in. And we're not allowed to go to the capital city, and there's a lot of red zones for obvious reasons. But there's I would not say we were sheltered from that at all. There, Guatemalans love to protest things in the middle of the highway, which is really irritating if you're trying to get someplace, but it definitely gets people's attention. So I think that Central America is a really interesting place right now. You have the continued drug problem, but like you said, in Guatemala, they held Rios Montt accountable for a few days. That sort of got sidetracked, but that was a big moment. Their vice president has just resigned in Guatemala under corruption charges, issues, concerns, and the people of Guatemala are still protesting nearly every weekend to try to get the president out. So definitely keep your eye on Central America. There's going to be a lot of changes. They're happening quickly. And it was very interesting to be down there. And another thing that was making the news a lot in Guatemala was the issue of unaccompanied minors crossing the border. And so that was really interesting to hear news at home. And, you know, Joe Biden came down and Jill Biden came down. And Guatemalans knew about it. Guatemalans were, even in rural villages, they were talking about it. Everyone had an opinion. And that was a very unique experience to get to hear both sides.
Did you get to meet Jill Biden?
I did get to meet Jill Biden, and that was awesome.
Yeah. Get that Delaware connection.
Oh, going. Yeah.
Leverage that.
She said, "Is anyone from Delaware?" And I said, "I went to the University of Delaware," and I was jumping up and down, and her security guards were inching closer to me. But she's a very nice lady.
In terms of the unaccompanied minors, because, you know, like you said, it was a huge story both there and here, it seemed like that eventually died down somewhat. Maybe the flow of people coming north stopped or at least significantly reduced. Was that, like, what was going on the ground? Were they just responding to the warnings about don't come here, you're going to get sent back? Or was it more complicated than that? What was going on that was affecting that sort of spike and then subsiding?
Yeah, so I think that the vice president in his visit down to Guatemala and other Central American countries made it clear that there's no way for us to take care of your children. And I think unaccompanied minors continue to cross the border and will continue to for a long time, which I think speaks volumes to how bad the situation is in Central America. If you're willing to send your 14-year-old kid to knowing that very well that they might not make it.
Or even 8 years old. Some of these kids were very young.
Yeah. And people down there all have a brother-in-law or cousin or somebody they know who tried to cross the border and they've never heard from again. So it's dangerous and they know it. And the fact that they continue to do it, I think, speaks volumes to the situation. But yeah, I think it was just more awareness about what was happening to those kids when they crossed the borders that turned the tide a little bit.
Last September on this show, we had a guest that was another UD person who was in the Peace Corps, Sarah Laskowski, who had been deployed to Guinea and then was pulled out because of the Ebola situation.
Right, now,
that she has managed to make that work out for her reasonably well under bad circumstances, you know, has gotten various promotions to be sort of a cultural ambassador to let ordinary people know about the situation and that it's still a big problem. And so she's ended up getting sent to various other countries.
Oh,
so
wow.
Not just one. But, you know, initially, I mean, that only happened because she wrote a very nice long post explaining about the situation and her feelings on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a very emotional experience getting pulled out. Was there ever any point that you got even close to getting pulled out because of a security issue or anything? Was that a concern?
Yes, for sure. That Guatemalan post is on thin ice. Being in that before I got there, they had not shut down the post, but they hadn't accepted any new volunteers for 18 months. And Guatemala is currently the most expensive post in the world to run, largely because of the security situation. We have two separate offices, so you can go to whichever one is close. And there's a shuttle that runs twice a day between the two offices. So they have done everything they can. And at this point, if things, you know, if it gets more dangerous, there's nothing else left for them to try. So they could close the post. But I know that they've been in Guatemala for 52 or 53 years now. So, and with all of the current attention on Central America, they're really trying not to do that. But we'll see.
That would be a real shame if they had to close it, but I think everyone would kind of understand if they had to.
Yeah, right? Especially we'll see what continues to happen with the president down there. And yeah, there's an inherent risk in being a Peace Corps volunteer, and people know that when they sign up. But there's also a responsibility to keep them reasonably safe and not put them directly in harm's way. And that's definitely a balancing act.
What were some things that you got to do, like, in free time outside of the, you know, project or even outside of the country? I know you got to travel around a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the benefits that I didn't even think of beforehand was how great all the other volunteers were going to be. And there was a group of 29 of us that started at the same time in the same group, and we just clicked. You just go through everything together. So I really enjoyed traveling with them within the country. Guatemala is beautiful. There's lakes and Tikal, which is ruins, beautiful ruins, and rainforest, and lots of beautiful things to see. So I enjoyed that. As you said, I also got to use my vacation time to travel through Panama, Costa Rica, and Nicaragua last December, and that was awesome. So I got to, knowing Spanish, I got to see a lot of new places and see a lot of new things, and I'm grateful for that experience.
What would you say would be some one or more big takeaways that you want Americans to know about Guatemala? I mean, you've mentioned some of it, I think, in passing, but what do you think is really important for people to know specifically about Guatemala?
Guatemala is our neighbor. Right south of Mexico. They're very close to us, and Guatemalans know everything about America. They were always teaching me things about America.
Do they have like American TV and stuff down there?
Oh, or? Yeah, American TV. Pacas are like secondhand clothes stores, so they all buy American clothes that they're wearing around. Just seeing them and knowing so many people who have family members in the States just sort of made the immigration issue a lot more personal. So I think that even if you can Google image Guatemala, it's the second most indigenous country in the Americas, right after Bolivia. So they have a really rich history of their indigenous cultures. And they, where I live, Spanish was everyone's second language. Mom, an indigenous language, was the first language. So it's a really rich culture, with for sure a lot of conflict, but also a lot of history. And I don't remember where I was going with this, but I just think that it's a beautiful country with beautiful people. And the fact that they are fleeing that country to America means that we need to pay more attention to what's happening in Central America, because they are so close to us. And they will continue to risk everything to come to America until there are more education opportunities and work opportunities in their own country.
That about covers all the questions that I had. Kelly, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about this. And obviously, we'll try to get you back on
soon.
Yeah,
thanks for having me back. Good to be back.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Well, there's been a lot of stuff happening this week and plenty of things that we could cover. I think we're going to have to leave some of them for the next episode, actually, though. Things like the Supreme Court decisions and healthcare and marriage equality and things like that. Also, the Greek economy may be about to fall apart completely. So those kind of things we're going to probably have to hold off and wait, because we had already planned out the segments for this show, and we needed to record a little bit earlier than usual this week. But we're going to focus actually in this segment on the Danish elections. which might seem a little bit narrow at first glance, but I think actually really helps illustrate a lot of the trends in Europe that we've been talking about in you know, the many, many episodes on this show, as well as sort of the bigger picture of politics in the 21st century and the advanced democracies. So the Danish elections happened a couple weeks ago at this point. And the party that had been running the government, the center-left Social Democrats, came in first. They actually gained seats, but all of their potential coalition partners lost seats. And so they're not going to be able to form a government, and so their leader resigned. The really huge development that surprised probably even them was that the right-wing Danish People's Party ended up coming in second place, significantly increasing both their vote share and their number of seats in the Danish parliament. And then the Liberal Party, or Venstre, came in third place. And so we're going to talk about kind of the potential arrangements that we might see coming out of a government, you know, in the short and long term. Even if they form a government between when we're recording this and when this episode goes out, it's very likely that it's not going to necessarily stay like that. Danish politics has been increasingly kind of unstable at the parliamentary level in recent years. And even the, you know, Social Democrats ended up like having some of their coalition partners drop out midterm without even triggering elections. So things are kind of constantly in an unstable state of flux there. But let's talk a little bit about the Danish People's Party. You know, Nate has a little bit of expertise in Danish politics, so he's going to kind of introduce some of this for us. Who are the DPP and what's their deal?
Yeah, well, the DPP is, I guess, a prime example of the sort of nativist political parties that we've seen crop up in a bunch of different European countries over the past couple years. I think Danish People's Party has probably been sort of a leader in that regards. They've sort of risen to prominence and have now seem to gain more political power than some of maybe the other comparable political parties in a lot of other countries. But yeah, I mean, it's a I guess a reaction, you could say, against a lot of the immigration that has taken place to Denmark, mainly from, I would say, Middle Eastern countries, a lot of refugees coming over. And the central, you know, premise, I guess, would be that these immigrants are not assimilating enough into Danish society. There's some sort of threat. They're taking welfare, you know, they're not getting jobs, too much unemployment, crime associated. So it's all this sort of, you know, xenophobic just reaction to people coming in. Probably a little bit of racism thrown in there as well, you know, just to complete the trappings. So, these are not super friendly, you know, pluralist type of guys. These are, you know, just, you know, your right wing, you know, this is not enormously different than some aspects of what you'd say the, I wouldn't necessarily want to tie them in completely with a Tea Party, but more of the Minutemen type, border security types that we have here in the US. So, you know, this is a similar type of reaction that we're seeing. And Denmark, obviously, it's a relatively homogeneous society. They have been for, you know, many years, developed a rather large social democracy system with welfare benefits and everything. And now their economic model, democratic model, is being tested a little bit by their willingness to accept refugees, because that has led to this sort of political divisiveness scenario where you have some people that are looking to, you know, try to include these refugees into Danish society. And on the other hand, you have others feeling like, oh, they're not going to fit in. We shouldn't even be helping them to try to fit in. And it just sort of leads to this, these cultural divides. But, you know, it is a challenging subject. And, you know, as we've seen, the rise of the Danish People's Party indicates that there are some people in Denmark that are not happy with this situation. And, you know, that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, in the U.S. media, the description has tended to be that this is a far-right party, which in many ways it definitely is. But one of the things, I mean, you mentioned how the Danish People's Party has been much more successful than many of its peer parties across Europe. They've previously served in coalition with the, you know, center-right in Denmark. in a much smaller role. This time they say that they're planning to sit it out and just be on the sidelines, which we can talk a little bit more about the strategy involved there. But, you know, beyond their sort of top line, you know, we don't want immigrants, they've become a very polished party, which is not like, which is not to say that they've moderated their positions. They've just figured out how to present it in a much more politically mainstream way that seems, you know, acceptable enough that they're considered a legitimate partner for a government or something like that. You know, you were mentioning about the social safety nets and the challenges facing the model there. One of the things that I think is really politically clever that they've done is that they've said that they're socially conservative and economically leftist, that they want to protect the welfare benefits and the social welfare state, something that, you know, obviously the center-right party has been trying to dismantle. They want their big, the liberals want to dismantle progressive taxation, you know, marginal top rates and things like that. But then also the center left party, the Social Democrats, haven't really done enough to protect that. They've sort of done the whole, you know, austerity light thing, which sort of a lot of these, you know, New Democrat, New Labor type parties that we talk a lot about on this show have tried to do as well. And so the Danish People's Party has basically exploited a niche of saying, well, the center right party's not strong enough against, you know, Europe and being Euroskeptical and against immigrants, but the center left party is also not doing enough to protect our welfare benefits. And then they tie it all together in a nice little bow by saying that the way to protect the welfare system is to keep immigrants away and prevent them from using it so that there will still be money.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would quibble with that a little bit because the Danish People's Party does look for a decrease in welfare entitlements as a way to make Denmark less attractive to welfare or asylum seekers. So it's more of like, let's protect it for ourselves.
Right.
Like not let them get any of it. So, I mean, it's sort of a different way of look, but I mean, it is similar to what you said. Another way that they're sort of changing the dialogue in Denmark has been on the immigration issue, because they've basically made it more acceptable to be anti-immigration. And they're basically creating a situation where the Liberal Party and the Social Democrats are now fighting it out between each other over who can be the most anti-immigrant. And that actually led to an interesting a little exchange from the head of the Red-Green Alliance, Joanne Schmidt-Nelson, who is more of a leftist candidate, in one of the debates. And so she threw a barb at Helle Thorning-Schmidt, basically saying, Helle, you're standing here in competition with the Blues. Those are right-wing parties. That's just a different way of naming them. But you're standing in competition with the Blues, but who can turn their back most on refugees? So it's just kind of like, hey, I mean, you're just joining in this this bash party, and you're just looking to try to, you know, exclude or gain political points on the backs of refugees rather than actually trying to come up with constructive solutions about how we can integrate them into society. And, you know, having been to Denmark a bunch of times, it is a very different society than we're used to here, because, you know, it's just extremely old. A lot of the buildings are just built from, you know, back in like the 1600s. There's a lot of things about society that's very progressive and forward thinking and modern, but it's not like the US where you just have this history of over hundreds of years, just new people coming and integrating themselves and adding on to the culture and developing new parts of culture and just becoming the new normal. It is, I feel, somewhat just challenging. You know, it's only been for a couple decades now that you have a lot of people coming in from Syria or Iraq or things like that. So, you know, you do have these conflicts, and it's not all necessarily coming from the sides of right-wing Danes. I guess one example coming from this very interesting article about some of the Muslim Democratic candidates in Denmark, talking about how they've been intimidated in some senses of just people coming up to them and saying that it's not Muslim to vote, participate in democracy. So you do have some pushback against some of the immigrant community in Denmark against the ideas of democracy. Of course, that's probably a relatively small minority. Most people that you, you know, especially if they're born in Denmark or, you know, they come at a very young age, might probably more likely to just look to join into the community. But at the same time, if you are getting intimidated, if you're just trying to run an election, that can create some problems within the Muslim community.
Now, you know, like you said, there are peer parties, particularly in the Scandinavian countries, that have made, you know, recent gains in the past, you know, 5 or so years, especially during the various Euro crisis things. There's, you know, Norwegians have a version of this, the Swedes have a version of this, the Finns have a version of this, you know, Finland's not Scandinavia, but still, we got that going on. There's sort of comparable, you know, parties in Poland that have made recent gains. And of course, we saw, you know, UKIP sort of flamed out a bit in Britain, but only because the Conservative Party basically adopted most of their, you know, key demands and principles there. We've got, you know, the Front National in France, and then you've got the various left-wing parties emerging in Southern Europe, you know, Portugal, Spain, Greece, even Italy to some extent, sort of left-ish leaning populist parties. Recently, you know, kind of looking from the outside in, Turkish academic Soli Özel had said, I forget what conference he was at, I was listening to a recording of this, and he made some comment about that the mainstream European political parties seem to be basically just trying to ignore this situation, that you've got these parties that are becoming dominant forces that did not exist, you know, in many cases earlier than the 1980s or the 90s, or even in some cases just a few years ago, you know, they're brand new. A lot of these mainstream parties were, you know, started entering parliament or even government in the 1890s, the 1910s, thereabouts. You know, the Labour Party in Britain emerged very rapidly in the first, you know, 15 to 20 years of the 20th century. A lot of these parties are quite old at this point, and they seem to be just hoping that this problem will just go away and that they won't have to deal with it. Now, in Denmark, which is, you know, like Britain, a little bit more Euroskeptical than some of the other countries that are part of the European Union, it seems like, for a while they tried to ignore the party and pretend that it would go away, and then they started actively embracing it. I mean, like you said, you had the Social Democrats under Helle Thorning-Schmidt basically trying to be, you know, almost as tough on immigration, but with a nicer face on it. You had the Conservative, the Liberal Party bringing them into government the last time around, and they probably won't be able to do that this time, but, you know, they certainly wanted to. You know, what's going on here? I mean, you've got either the open embrace of these parties from the mainstream or just trying to ignore them and hope that they'll go away. I mean, are they going to go away? Is this a short-term thing, do you think? Or is this here to stay, that there's a new sort of emergence of parties that are potentially going to become the major parties in a lot of these countries?
Yeah, I'm not sure if these are going away anytime soon. I mean, that's what's really concerning here, is that it seems like they've become, in many ways, normalized because some of their ideas are seeping into the political mainstream. As I just mentioned, now the other Danish candidates are competing to take up part of their political platform, maybe not have the same invectives as a part of it, but they're still looking to shift the dialogue in ways that benefit the Danish People's Party. And, you know, I hate to bring, I guess, like the specter of terrorism into it, but there was a terrorist attack in Denmark, you know, at the I believe the Norrbro district. Been there a couple times, just, you know, normal neighborhood in the sort of downtown area. You know, a couple people were killed, I guess, one at a synagogue, another at like a free speech cafe, and, you know, this, I guess, radicalized.
When was this attack? This,
now, I believe this was in February, so this is a couple months ago. But, you know, it just seems like a radicalized, I guess, person might have been a gangster at one point. It's not like this is some sort of like jihad attack launched from afar, but at the same time, it is, you know, pretty disconcerting that you have just someone opening fire, and killing people. So that could potentially push people towards a more radicalized right-wing political party as a reaction, or at least people that were on the margins, or maybe until, you know, they felt the possibility of they themselves might be killed by radical terrorists, then all of a sudden they might start voting for Danish People's Party, and there have probably been other instances in other countries that have, you know, worked in similar ways. We talked about the Charlie Hebdo attacks. Wonder if that could influence people to vote for the National Front. You know, what is the impacts of that? And I guess as you see more just debates or incidences or friction over issues of Islamic terrorism, Islamic immigration into Europe, you know, you probably will continue to see a, maybe not a majority in any country, hopefully not, but maybe, and maybe not even pluralities, but strong concentrated minorities like forming into these political blocks and just sort of coming out of the shadows as established anti-immigrant political parties and political movements. And, you know, on the one hand, that's pretty disconcerting, but on the other hand, maybe it's better that they're out in the open actually, rather than sort of just being underground and committing like vigilante violence and things like that. I mean, who knows? But
I suppose it's better to give them an outlet at the ballot box.
Yeah. Well, unless they start winning and, you know, creating all these even further problems.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting point, and this is something that I've brought up as well, you know, with, you know, something like UKIP in Britain versus the mainstream British Conservative Party. Is it better to have these parties out in the open as their own separate party, or is it better to have them as we have in with the Republican Party in the United States, where they're basically incorporated into one of the mainstream parties, but they're sort of the back bench of it, or, you know, the fringe that can be somewhat controlled by the mainstream and, you know, non-hardline leadership? I don't know the answer to that question. I think that's an interesting point that you make. Regarding the point about pluralities and majorities, I want to get into that a little bit here, sort of the strategic outlook. According to an article that I was reading in The Guardian, which I posted a link to on arsenalfordemocracy.com, you know, the last time that a party tried to form a government with as few seats as the Liberal Party has, well, it was even fewer seats, actually, but it was like 1970 or something like that. I mean, this is going to be a tiny, tiny government here. Something like, I think 19% of the seats in parliament are controlled by the Liberal Party. That's a nowhere near a majority. And that government in 1970 lasted, you know, like 24 months or 20 months, something like that. In general, apparently in Denmark, the average length of a term for a one party government, you know, a minority government like this is 2.5 years, according to the statistics that were quoted in that article. So what we're very likely going to see is, because the Danish People's Party is refusing to participate in this new government, unlike, you know, the previous time where they were a much smaller party, so they were the junior partners, they're actually larger than the party that's going to form the government. But they're saying, and I think this is very politically savvy, they're saying, you know what, we're just not going to participate in it. We're not going to be in the government. So we're not going to have to share the responsibility of anything that goes wrong in the next few years. And in all likelihood, there will be early elections that they're going to be very well positioned to do quite well in. Because the reality of this, I think, and maybe you can weigh in on this as well, is that, you know, the Liberal Party is going to need to count on support from the Social Democrats. That's going to be very difficult to pull off. And if that, basically, it's going to be an unstable, bumpy road for the next few years. The economy is going to have some difficulties because of that, in all likelihood. And both mainstream parties will then come out 2.5 years from now looking quite bad. There will be an election held. And then I think it's very possible that the Danish People's Party could end up coming in first. I mean, they were only, I think, about 10 seats back from the first place Social Democrats this time. So they are now completely within striking distance. And, you know, they won the EU elections in Denmark, and that was obviously a much lower turnout election. But then, as you said, they managed to sustain this into this election. They got almost the same percentage in this election as they did in the EU election, where almost no one voted, you know, relatively speaking, compared to this. So I think this, you know, it's very possible that strategically there's going to be a very unstable government for a couple years at the most. That gets very little done, just makes a lot of people angry. And then, you know, out of the rubble of this is going to be the Danish People's Party saying, you know, we're going to keep out the immigrants, we're going to stop the terrorism, and we're going to protect your, you know, social benefits if you're a white Danish person like us.
Yeah. And, you know, as we've seen, that the fact that they're staying out of government, maybe allowing themselves to just paint themselves as positive benefits on the sidelines that could be a benefit of them in the coming years. Another thing I think is interesting is how they're targeting voters and what they're trying to do to bring voters in. One article in the Financial Times notes that they're actually mostly targeting older voters, which, you know, would make sense considering that potentially older voters might be less likely to be super welcoming towards immigrants. And another thing they're doing is really going after the animal vote, or I guess the people with animals vote. They have like bowls of water for dogs at all their campaign events, and like that's something that people are into. But like, I mean, that could win votes.
Taking populism to a new level.
Well, that's the thing. They are a populist party in many ways, unless you're brown, I guess so.
Right. It's a very narrow popule that they're appealing
not
to.
Not every populist, but just a couple. So, yeah, you have this as being a potential driving factor. And then you throw in the whole, like, EU situation and various economic things about the euro. And, like, there are all these intertwining pieces whenever you're talking about the EU or Euroscepticism or these Eurosceptic parties. So, I mean, that can always play a factor into it. For some people, it might be the main factor, but we'll see. I mean, I just don't want to, I don't want a Denmark that's ruled by the Danish People's Party. I think that's potentially pretty dangerous.
Right. I want to just bring this briefly back around to the United States before we close out. You know, I've been vaguely alluding to my criticisms of the Social Democrats becoming sort of like New Labor or New Democrats. Honestly, you know, one of my concerns is that Helle Thorning-Schmidt is a preview of what a first-term Hillary Clinton presidency would be like. You know, somewhat different circumstances, certainly. But, you know, there's an Irish Times report from before the election that I felt like I just kept on hearing echoes of, okay, this is what Hillary Clinton's going to do, especially if she's running for, you know, gets elected and then is running for re-election. So this is talking about Helle Thorning-Schmidt. Her centrist, some would say liberal, reform drive has won over Denmark's business leaders. Now she hopes to win over reform-weary voters with a promise of 5 billion euros in additional spending. She launched a publicity campaign appearing to take a tougher line in immigration. You know, put up posters with, you know, a picture of her smiling and quotes under it, "If you come to Denmark, you should work," which is not very coded, but is somewhat coded language there. You know, that she's praised for her straight talking on a long time taboo issue, you know, kind of going out of the way to appear tough on something, you know, whether it's crime or immigration or something like that, while saying that, you know, that it's not as extreme as the position there. You know, and apparently, you know, that she ultimately, the rest of the coalition didn't succeed, but this did, as you said, end up winning more seats for the Social Democrats. You know, their party strategist said, "We have tightened the requirements of how many immigrants we have so our society can absorb and handle them. And we ask of immigrants here nothing more than we ask of Danes, that they work and contribute to our society." Right? They make it sound very nice, but at its core, it's still the same, like, negative antagonistic policies that comes from the starting point assumption that, you know, immigrants are doing something wrong or that they're not like us, that kind of thing. And I worry that this is the kind of sort of triangulation that we've seen Hillary Clinton do before, you know, and Bill Clinton certainly. I think that, you know, running on a sort of, well, I'm a responsible reformer who's going to pass market-friendly reforms and also be tough on crime and immigration. I mean, that to me just screams like Hillary Clinton. And of course, the other big parallel here is that Thorning-Schmidt, coming from this sort of center-left party or whatever, also the first female leader of Denmark. I don't know. Do you see the parallels here, or am I reading too much into this? I don't know. I could be going, you know, too much on the similarities there.
I mean, platinum blonde hair dye. I mean, that's one similarity. Yeah, I mean, just some of the things that we've talked about with her screen triangulation and fun Clintonian aspects of that. But, I mean, we'll see. We haven't even had the election yet or any of the primaries, so
right.
This is all very hypothetical. But whether or not, just also considering that it's president versus, you know, just prime minister, much less power, and then was able to be toppled in an election where her party actually gained seats, which is, you know, that is possible in a parliamentary system, as we've seen, but that would never happen here in the U.S., I don't think. So,
you know, I mean, right. They have a
majority. It would be odd, though, if she lost the election, but the Democrats, like, retook the Senate or something.
Right, that's true.
Which would be more analogous, but also there's no, like, sea changes and the numbers of parties are different and everything. So it's all very difficult to compare. But, yeah, there are similarities there.
All right. Well, you know, as I said, I think it's important to focus on this election because in Denmark that just happened because of how it sort of encapsulates a lot of themes that we've been seeing across a lot of the advanced democracies of the world, and particularly in Europe, this rise of populists, in fact, pretty extreme populists in this case, becoming potentially a mainstream and very likely permanent force in these political situations here. Nate, thank you so much for joining me here on Arsenal for Democracy this week.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.